Blog Talk Radio.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, no concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way. A letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, no concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way.
Movement, music, moving to it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life. This movement, music, moving to it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life.
Word is
any kind of activity that takes place on the floor of the Congress or the Senate, that's the government. Any kind of dilly-dallying, that's the government. Any kind of pussy-footing, that's the government. Any kind of act that's designed to delay, or deprive you and me right now of getting full rights, that's the government that's responsible. And any time you find the government involved in a conspiracy,
I can never go back. Life without parole, upstate, shackled and trapped. Living in the hole, looking at the world through a crack. Fuck that, I'd rather shoot it out and get clapped. I've gone too far, there ain't no coming back for me. Auschwitz gas chamber full of Zyklon B. Just like the Spanish exterminating Tainos, raping the black and Indian women, creating Latinos. Motherfucker, upmade me out of self-righteous hatred. And now you got yourself a virus, stuck in the matrix. A suicide bomber, strapped and ready to blow. Lethal injection, strapped down, ready to go. Don't you understand, they'll never let me live out in peace. Concrete jungle, guerrilla war out in the streets. Nat Turner with the sickle, pitchfork and machete. The end of the world, motherfucker, are you not ready?
DJ Tony Drake.
This is DJ Tony Drake, a.k.a. Mr. Top Shelf himself. And right now, you're in tune to Your World News, where journalism and activism are not mutually exclusive. Here on yourworldnews.org.
You can't tell me life was meant to be like this. A black man in a world dominated by whiteness ever since the Declaration of Independence. We've been easily brainwashed by just one sentence. It goes, all men are created equal. That's why corrupt governments kill innocent people. With chemical warfare, they created crack and AIDS. Got the public thinking these were things that black folks made. And every time there's violence shown in the media, usually it's a black thing. So where are they leading you? To a world full of ignorance, hatred and prejudice. TV and the news for years, they're prejudiced. Foolish notion that blacks are all criminals. Violent lowlifes, and then even animals. I'm telling the truth, so some suckers are fearing me, but I must do my part to combat the conspiracy.
Yes, welcome to another edition of Your World News. This is March the 2nd, 2012. Welcome. It's been, once again, one of those long hiatuses that we sometimes have on Your World News just because we're caught up in a realm of other things, trying to contribute and embolden the Your World News website. That's yourworldnews.org. That's yourworldnews.org. When you go there, you can check out our blog, but also check out some of the videos that we post with our correspondents getting out in the streets and covering things like the recent protest to end mass incarceration in D.C. And it was part of a nationwide solidarity with prisoners who are locked up in America's gulags. So here we are. It's another edition, and we've got a once again, I say it all the time, a bit redundant, another special episode. We have Danny Weil, who will be joining us about 15 past the hour to discuss around the things surrounding education and not the least recent Supreme Court case that is going to be heard in the not-too-distant future, which could have some really deleterious ramifications regarding affirmative action. And so he'll give us the backdrop of that case, but he'll even delve deeper into affirmative action in general. And then we'll talk about charter schools, its impact on inner-city population, which, as we know, is mostly black and brown folks. And yeah, so this is going to be an important episode, as usual. And I'm joined in studio today by Nisa Williams, who is our Your World News student correspondent. And I just want to give you the floor, Nisa, you know, to say hello to our listeners and any thoughts you might have on the state of affairs nationally and globally.
First of all, I just say thank you for having me back again. And it's a pleasure just to be bringing you some new things to think about for a new day, new year, and everything. With affirmative action, and especially when it comes to education, it's something I want to know more about, and Mr. Weil is basically an expert in that field. And I was talking to a fellow scholar, Dr. Randy Schatz, and we were just, Dr. Randy Schatz and also Dr. Issa from the University of Delaware State University, and we were just thinking like the gains that all people fought for during the civil rights era, it looks like we have been taking like major steps backwards instead of progressing forward. So today is it's a good day to be intellectually challenged.
Yeah, definitely. And hopefully that intellectual challenge moves folks to action because we have to move our intellectual capacities and our desire to continue to learn and become critically engaged to actions, you know, mobilization, organization, and actions that are all squared up, you know, ready to take out the system of injustice, institutional racism, white supremacy, and so forth and so forth. But it has to be a concerted effort, especially a concerted effort for those most dispossessed, those most oppressed, and those are people of color within America's various communities, mostly inner cities. Black and brown skin folks have to come together. Black, brown, Asians, Native Americans, Pacific Islands have to come together and see that and understand that America is riddled with institutional racism. America is a white settler state. And as long as it stands as being that, as long as we are politically disengaged, then we will continue to vote for Democrats, believing that they are the answer to the nefarious right-wing folks that are commonly called Republicans. And as long as we think that way, then we are going to continue to be sheep for slaughter, because the Democrats do not anymore have our interests at heart than do the Republicans. The Democrats are just better at masking it. So without further ado, let's start off with a Black Agenda Report. Black Agenda Report commentary from Brother Glenn Ford. And on the other end, we'll probably be joined by Dr. Danny Weil. So here's Glenn Ford talking about the NYPD spying on Muslim communities, not just in New York, but also outside of New York.
African Americans have always been systematically associated with crime in America as a means of making them outlaws in their own land. Since 9/11, Muslims have been systematically linked with terrorism in an attempt to depict the entire group as a clear and present danger to the American state. It should come as no surprise, then, that the internal logic of a racist and repressive society leads the U.S. to place black Muslims under extraordinary surveillance. You can find a lot of black Muslims in a place like Newark, New Jersey, which is why the New York City Police have for years been sending undercover officers out of their jurisdiction to spy on Newark. Top local Democrats express outrage at the surveillance, which kept track of the goings-on at such dangerous centers of terrorism as an African-American school for first to fourth grade kids and a black all-girls private school in Newark. The NYPD sent spies into restaurants and neighborhood groceries and saturated every mosque in the city with agents and informers, what the police call mosque crawlers, which sounds to my ear like a kind of cockroach. Top Democrats in New Jersey, including Newark's mayor, Cory Booker, say they're angry at New York City. Senator Robert Menendez wants U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder to do an investigation. But President Barack Obama's administration is actually paying some of the bill for the cops that New York sent to spy on Newark and localities throughout the region. New York City diverts millions of dollars in federal anti-drug money, overseen by the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, and spends it on surveillance of Muslims. The Federal Department of Homeland Security hands out millions to the NYPD, but refuses to discuss how the money is spent. And Attorney General Eric Holder's top civil rights lawyer has repeatedly refused to comment on the civil liberties implications of New York's vast surveillance program. Clearly, the Obama administration's silence means consent. There is nothing ambiguous about the NYPD mission. It is designed to target whole communities as nests of terror. The surveillance is largely carried out by what is called the demographic unit, whose purpose is to spy on a whole demographic slice of residents, in this case Muslims, to map out how they live in the minutest detail and to record who is saying what to whom. In practice, it is as if the police saturated every Italian-American neighborhood, restaurant, business, social club, church, school, and playground in order to find out more about the mafia. Of course, such police state tactics would not be tolerated by Italian Americans or by their fellow white Christians. But when Muslims, and especially Muslims who are black, are targeted for hyper-surveillance, well, that's a different story. When little black girls at the Al-Hadaya and Al-Muslimat academies in Newark are placed under anti-terror surveillance, then we know that genocide is not beyond the realm of possibility. When undercover cops make note of the ethnicity of every person who enters a mosque in New York City or Newark, New Jersey, then we know that whatever solution the police have in mind to whatever problem they think they have is an ethnic and racial solution. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
So, Nisa, that was Glenn Ford breaking it down very thoroughly, as he usually does. I want to ask you your feedback on that piece right there. And you know, to me, it as he broke down, it likens itself to what this country has been doing, not just to Muslims. In this case, you know, they're spying on black Muslims, but this is, you know, large part and parcel of what America has been doing to communities of color for a long time.
Well, for one, it does continue with that history of building the case against the black people in America. So if you have intense surveillance on this one group of people, it's basically telling everyone else that that group is dangerous. So if anything should happen to that group, well, it's because they were doing something bad in the first place. So it, those types of things only reiterate what, I guess, what history and, you know, the people who run this country is trying to do to the black race, which is a genocide. And it shows that another thing again that Obama and his administration are not willing to do anything to that end to help out, or even, you know, hell, they're even funding the operation. So those Obama supporters, you know, time to do some critical thinking, ask yourself questions.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. If they haven't critically thought thus far, they're probably not. I wish that was the case, that these folks that still continue to support Obama. And I'm glad we're going to be talking about education with Danny Wild. But, you know, looking at what Obama has done in his 3 years as a president, expanding the war in Afghanistan, I mean, within his first 72 hours, orchestrating, you know, and ordering drone strikes in Afghanistan and Pakistan, taking lives that are civilians, and basically not even batting an eye about it. And you know, I heard someone recently say something really interesting, you know, a comrade of mine saying something interesting. People are always talking about, oh, if we voted for McCain, you know, that was going to be an extension of that was going to be like Bush's third term, an extension of Bush, and would be in essence like a third term of Bush. Well, this Obama presidency has been more than an extension of Bush. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's worse. And I say that, and people are shocked, but you know, Bush, like these like so-called liberals out there. At least they knew, you know, looking at Bush, you know what he was doing. It was clear to see, you know. They looked at some of his policies, and then saw this guy, this white guy, this ultra, you know, conservative, you know, white guy, you know, who's, you know, yes, he was mentally challenged, remains mentally challenged. But looking at Obama, man, we have this slick talking, brown skinned guy from, from Chicago and Hawaii, and just changes up his talk, you know, based on who his crowd is. If he's talking to a black crowd, you know, changes up. He's real slick and goes in there. He can sing a little Al Green and sounds real smooth. And for some reason, these Obama supporters, you know, especially those that are black, they continue to support this guy and are just wowed by him. Don't give a damn about the substance. Don't give a damn about the substance. Are just wowed by his slick, you know, his slick talking and singing, and we saw this to a certain extent with Bill Clinton playing the saxophone. But this is on a whole nother level. It is just beyond me that folks, you know, refuse to see what this guy has done domestically and globally, and how it is a direct affront to any liberation oriented person, any social justice oriented person, black, white, brown, yellow, what have you. Obama is an affront to that, but unfortunately, many of those folks within every single group that I just named continue to support and make excuses for this guy. But one person that doesn't make excuses for Obama is Danny Wild, and Danny is a friend of Your World News. He is a frequent contributor to the blog. He also writes for outlets like Truth Out. He's written for Counterpunch, frequently contributes to Daily Censored, is an author many times over, has written an unbelievable book, on a very comprehensive book on charter schools, is not just an educational scholar, but he's an activist, and that's why folks like Danny Wild are so important, because he puts the boots to the ground. He gets out there with the people. He helps organize. He organizes, takes initiatives. He is an active participant. He does analysis, I should say, through participation, and not analysis through observation. Far too many people just analyze things through observation, looking and sitting down, and wouldn't go anywhere near a rally or mobilization. Wouldn't put their time to it. Will just sit there behind their keyboard and write. Danny Wild, he's the complete polar opposite. Danny Wild puts his boots to the ground. He organizes, helps organize, contributes, and so forth. And it's a pleasure to have him back on the show again. And so without further ado, I'd like to welcome Dr. Danny Wild from California on the show right now. Danny, can you hear us?
I sure can, Solomon. Thank you for the nice introduction.
Not a problem. Danny, before we get started, I want to play this clip from Glenn Ford from Black Agenda Report, which you're very familiar with the work of Glenn Ford. I want to play this clip It's a 3-minute clip, and on the other end, that's the way I want to start this interview. I want to get your initial reaction to this. It's something that you have covered for a long time now, but I know a lot of our listeners, it's kind of sort of new information too, so I want to see if I can get you to deconstruct this. And so without further ado, this is Glenn Ford talking about the recent mass firings in Chicago public schools.
If you have any doubt that President Obama and his cronies are at the forefront of public school privatization and the decimation of black teachers, just take a look at Chicago. That's where Obama's basketball buddy, Arne Duncan, wreaked havoc as school's chief until the new president appointed him Secretary of Education, and where Obama's former White House chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, now reigns as mayor with overall control of the public schools. Arne Duncan fired 1,300 Chicago teachers during his 8 years at the helm, the large majority of them black women, replaced by mostly white, younger teachers at about half the cost. The teachers' union sued, charging racial discrimination, a case that is still before the courts. Now, with 1,000 more teachers fired last year under Mayor Rahm Emanuel, the union has filed a complaint with the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, once again charging racial discrimination. Blacks currently make up only 29% of Chicago's teachers, but they comprised 43% of those recently fired. Whites represent almost half the teaching force, but only 36% of the layoffs. The union's lawyer calls it a systematic effort to rid Chicago public schools of tenured teachers who are African American. Community groups have joined the teachers in asking the courts to halt the closing of 17 supposedly underperforming schools, many of them on the city's south side. In Chicago, such closings wipe out the school's entire workforce, right down to the janitors, whose performance, of course, has nothing to do with standardized test scores. But wholesale staff massacres clear the way for charter schools operated by private teaching corporations. The Academy of Urban School Leadership, a national charter school founded by a venture capitalist, once employed the current CEO of the Chicago Public Schools. The new crop of young white teachers are largely graduates of programs funded by a who's who of right-wing foundations and corporations, the people educator Diane Ravitch calls the Billionaire Boys Club. President Obama has advanced the corporate project to privatize public education with lightning speed, inflicting far more damage in far less time than George Bush ever could, because George Bush is not a black Democrat. Bush's men called the teachers' unions terrorists and other bad names, but Barack Obama has been a much more effective servant of the privatizers. Their goal is not just to break the teachers' unions, but to deprofessionalize education and to sunder all ties between teachers and the communities they serve. That's why black teachers have been targeted for mass firing in Chicago and all across the country. They tend to have tenure and to be staunch supporters of their unions, and they live in the communities where they work as neighbors, parents, and leaders. When Barack Obama and Arne Duncan and Rahm Emanuel target black teachers for mass elimination, they deliver a savage blow to African American community cohesion. Privatization of public schools is a central part of the disempowerment of Black America. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
Danny, yes. Care to expound upon that?
Well, there's many directions to follow up on it at. I mean, we can make it Chicago specific and take a look at that. Why don't we do that? Listeners should know that this plan is been into effect, and I'll explain it, since 2004. It was called Renaissance 2010 in Chicago. Under the former Mayor Daley, it was launched in 2004. The head of the Commercial Club of Chicago, this club goes back to the 1800s. It is a business union, far more powerful than the Chamber of Commerce. It's very specific to Chicago, and it's made up of all the business elites in Chicago, very much like the Federal City Council in Washington, D.C., a very covert one-tenth of 1% club. They got together in 2004, and they told Daley, they said, look, we're going to have to do something about education in this city because we need to break the backs of the unions. And they were after to break the back of the 37,000 members of the teachers' union in Chicago. So this started in 2004, and charter schools were, of course, were part of the plan. Closing public schools was the other part of the plan. The person that was picked to actually be the head of the execution of public schools was Arne Duncan. And Arne Duncan served well for the club for about 8 years, where he militarized the schools, closed schools, opened charter schools. And then he was picked by Obama to be the head of the DOE, Department of Education. And the plan is going forward now. The great thing that Chicago has going for them is they have a fascist by the name of Rahm Emanuel, who is a person who stated openly, never allow a crisis to go by without using it. So he's basically using what is called the shock doctrine, and listeners can read Naomi Klein, create a crisis, and then come in and use that crisis, in this case, to privatize the schools, to break the backs of the teachers' unions, and to close public education. So that's how I would follow up initially.
Right. And it seems, you know, that this is going on in other cities as well, such as New York. I was reading something this week that this is, correct me if I'm wrong, are we starting to see this spread throughout other cities as well, such as New York City?
Well, actually, once again, this did start back in 2004, and Texas was involved, and Los Angeles, and New York, and Chicago. Basically, what the privatizers have done, and what's interesting to understand, they take the commercial club in Chicago, for example. It's a union. Okay, now, they don't pay dues and they don't sign cards to join. It's a group of like-minded, basically men, very very rich, one-tenth of 1% of the population men, and they get together and they make public policy.
Right.
That's a union. That's a union. So when they say they're against unions, they're not against unions. They're against working people's unions. They love unions for themselves. So, yes, this is going on everywhere. They've closed schools in Los Angeles. 2 years ago, they turned over the titles of 11 public schools to the privatizers in Los Angeles. Just basically summoned them down to City Hall, and like you would do a pink slip on a car, just turned it over and signed the pink slip over of the schools to these people. They own the real estate now. So
right.
This is asset stripping going on as well. We're taking centuries of taxpayer-funded institutions and either closing them or just giving them wholesale to the privatizers. So all the struggles that have gone in the last, you know, 70 years in some of these public schools, the fights between unions and management, collective bargaining, and the fights to help the kids and to set up, you know, breakfast programs and all this, just in one fell swoop, just cut them. Finally, not to get windy on this, listeners can look at what happened in New Orleans when the hurricane was used as the crisis. Joe Klein, who was working there at the time and went on to work for Bloomberg in New York and now works for Fox News. He was the head of the school district there. He closed not only so many schools, he laid off 4,500 teachers in one fell swoop. So
wow.
This isn't the first time this has happened. Okay, this happened in 2006. So in one fell swoop, the entire teachers' union was just laid off. They just gone. And these were mostly black teachers, like, you know, Ford says, work in their community, have ties to their community, generally, because government is a big employer for a lot of black folks, as well as a lot of Latinos and a lot of other, quote, minority, unquote, people. You know, there tends to be a strong a favor for the government, and rightly so. And so the attack is definitely being aimed at black people and is definitely being aimed at black kids and minority kids as they're more militarized, the schools.
Right. Thank you for that end of the answer, Danny. And I wanted to shift, but everything is connected and one just nefarious way after another. I wanted to shift. I wanted to know if you could give our listeners a background of the current the current situation surrounding affirmative action and the case in Texas, and I believe the Supreme Court is going to be hearing this case. If you could give our listeners, because I know that this is something that has been conveniently left off of a lot of mainstream networks, airwaves, and so forth, in any kind of comprehensive manner. If you could give a background, and then maybe, you know, even before that, break down what affirmative action is, like what affirmative action is, what's the derivation of affirmative action, and what is it supposed to do, and you know, why this case could have dramatic ramifications on affirmative action in regards to admissions to higher educational institutions.
Okay, well, I'll try to accomplish that without, you know, going into a lot of windy words, and that'll allow you then to ask more questions, which will elicit more thoughts on this. And basically, I think the best way to start is historically. You see, what we're facing right now is not conservatives. What we're facing right now are reactionaries, and there's a really big difference. A conservative might be like Eisenhower when he was in the White House. He would be a liberal today. A Kennedy, Nixon, wage and price controls and Environmental Protection Agency, and this would be considered, you know, socialist today. So we're not talking about conservatives that are launching attacks on affirmative action and education. We're talking about reactionaries, and therefore we have to ask ourselves, what is a reactionary? A reactionary is basically a person who is very upset with the fact that there's no slavery in this country anymore. So they would be very, very upset at the abolitionist movement, and they were at the time of the abolitionist movement. They're racist. Secondly, they believe in hierarchy. Everything has got to be hierarchy. So a vertical arrangement of society is the reactionary's wet dream. And in that vertical relationship of society, blacks are not to have the same rights as white people. Women are definitely not to have the same rights as men. And so patriarchy and racism and, of course, anti-working class of sentiments. So therefore, workers are nothing more than hand tools for the capitalists to make more profit, and therefore they shouldn't have any rights, and they're lucky if they're even working, because the reactionaries believe that they create jobs, when in all actuality, if it wasn't for working people, there would be no capital in the capitalism or capital, because all wealth comes from working people. It doesn't come from capitalists. Capitalists don't create wealth. They create opportunities for people to work to create wealth for them. So given this, then, the current-day reactionaries, if you look at what they're doing throughout the United States today, from the Deep South, where they're kind of a new Southern strategy, all the way to the, you know, to New York or anywhere else, from charter schools to everywhere else, there are attack on black people, attack on newly arriving immigrants, attack on women, and attack on working people. And therefore, you have basically a blowback movement that's very strong right now. What's it blowing back against? It's blowing back against the abolitionist movement, the women's suffrage movement, the gay rights movement or LGBT movement, the unionization movement that took place in the, you know, last century, from the progressive era all the way, you know, up until the 1970s when unions started losing their power. And that's what we've been seeing in the last 32 years. It's just an attack against working people with those various ideas in mind. So women are to be barefoot in the kitchen. They can't have birth control. They're not allowed to make any decisions over their reproductive rights. Black people are to live in the new Jim Crow, a separate but unequal, and they're supposed to accept that, and working people are to work in right-to-work states and not have minimum wage and no protections and no environmental protections, nothing. So this is a kickback against really the Enlightenment. It goes, you know, that there was the birth of our country and the birth of France and the birth of Haiti, for example. The Enlightenment movement, you know, which was from the 1700s, the late 1700s, up until, we could say, approximately recently. And now it's being basically repealed. So getting into affirmative action, we had a situation, as you know and your listeners will know, we had a civil war. And then we had, following the civil war, we had about, 15 years of Reconstruction. where black people began to make gains in this country. You know, they were moving out of the yoke of racism and exploitation and oppression, and began to make gains, began to elect people to office, began to take care of their own business. And then what came into being was Jim Crow in the 1880s, and basically in the 1890s with the decision in Plessy versus Ferguson, which was a Supreme Court decision whereby the decision was that separate but equal, they said, was legal. Therefore, a whole rash of laws were passed after that. There was to be no integration, discrimination in boarding houses, discrimination in restaurants, discrimination. Okay, so a separate but equal clause was made. Well, there was a struggle. Then what came was what we know as Jim Crow, which is named after a minstrel character, but basically was a situation where blacks were basically kept in slave-like conditions, only with no slavery. So they were leased out, for example. Blacks were leased out in the prison system up until the 1950s in this country. Many people don't know this. Well, of course, W.E.B. Du Bois in the early 1900s, as well as a number of movements from Marcus Garvey to the NAACP, there was a lot of movements in the 1900s or the 20th century, black people fighting for their rights to get out of the yoke of course, this horrible new Jim Crow. Well, basically in 1954, we had the decision rendered in Brown versus Board of Education that Plessy was overruled. And thus in the 40s, really a lot of it came out after World War II when there was an integration of black people in the military to some extent. There was a movement that came out of this afterwards, of course, to fight for black people to fight for their rights. And one of the things that happened was that in 1961, before the Civil Rights Act was ever enacted, John F. Kennedy issued an executive order, 10925, which created the Committee on Equal Employment Opportunity, and out of that comes the word affirmative action. So that was really the first time it appeared. Then Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act in 1964, creating affirmative action. Now, what is affirmative action? All right, affirmative action basically is a mechanism that people have advocated to overcome the effect of past societal discrimination by allocating jobs or resources to specific groups. So there's not just affirmative action for black people, there's affirmative action for women, because women make 77%. So women make 77 cents for the same job that a man works that makes a dollar. Okay, so obviously there's discrimination going on against women as well, and so affirmative action was put into place to allocate resources in jobs or university for students who apply to a university to make up for past racial discrimination, to increase diversity. There are a number of reasons people support affirmative action, but it was basically to create opportunities for black people and women in our country right now. However, we're living in what's called a new Jim Crow. And all the gains made in the 1950s and all the struggles for the civil rights movement from 63 and all the Black Panther work and all the work that women have done is now under attack. It wants to be repealed by the reactionaries. The reactionaries don't want people to have equal rights. They believe in inequality. They believe in inequality as a natural state of human beings. And therefore, any social contract has to include inequality. So they're bucking up against it now, and they're putting in a new Jim Crow. And part of the new Jim Crow is the drug wars, the stop and frisk and search, the massive incarceration of black people, and fighting against affirmative action, fighting against all these type of laws that allowed people to get a little leg up on the ladder. Okay, and that's what's coming up in front of the courts, and it has to do with the situation of admissions into a college. Now, in 2003, the University of Michigan came up to the U.S. Supreme Court to find out if their affirmative action quotas were legal. And the court ruled in 2003 that affirmative action was legal, but strict quotas were not. Well, we have a new Supreme Court, and, of course, it includes Clarence Thomas, the man who benefited from affirmative action, who is now its greatest enemy. And the justices, another union, okay, of like-minded individuals, made a decision that they want to get rid of affirmative action, and so that probably is what will be what happens, is affirmative action will be overruled by the U.S. Supreme Court.
All right. Lisa?
Yes. In terms of education and what is going on with Texas and previous cases on or against affirmative action, what would be, how negatively would it affect the people, like people of color, and let's say blacks, Latinos, and women in general?
Well, you know, we can take a look at how it has affected. And so, for example, in I think it's 1996 here in the state of California, we had Ward Connolly running around, as he's done in many states, putting on the ballot to get rid of affirmative action. And indeed they did. In California, they got rid of affirmative action. What happened? Well, the amount of black people, for example, in law school went down to 5%. The amount of women went way down. I mean, just you saw that the enrollments in the schools, medical schools, law schools, it just plummeted with the amount of minority or black or Latino students or women in them. So one would make the argument that without affirmative action, there is less diversity and less people going into these professions, et cetera. On the other hand, those against affirmative action would argue, and to affirmative action was never meant to be the end all. It was meant to be something that we would use until we got to the, quote, colorblind society. Well, now we're being told by the reactionaries that we live in a colorblind society, and we don't need affirmative action anymore, okay, because the Constitution doesn't judge people by their color, we're told. They even evoke Martin Luther King, you know, to talk about don't judge somebody by their color, so forth and so on. But the bottom line is that affirmative action doesn't get rid of racism, and it doesn't assure that people are not discriminated against. It was a mechanism, an in-between mechanism that its authors hoped to use until there was the fight for racial equality actually came to fruition. But as I'm saying, that fight now is going in reverse as we see more and more Jim Crow, more and more oppression, more and more discrimination. So we hardly live in a post-racial society. We hardly live in a colorblind society. We live in a society that's far more racialized and racist today than I think it's ever been. So the answer to you, the statistics will bear it out, is it enrollment in these schools plummet?
Thank you, Danny. Danny, I wanted to ask you, we've touched on some of the things that have gone on in places like Chicago. You know, you gave us the backdrop looking at when Arnie Duncan, the current Secretary of Education, was the CEO. that should tell folks something. It's like more of these cities, what used to be called superintendent is now called CEO, but he was the former CEO of Chicago, and he you know, militarized the schools and corporatized them, and what we now call is charter school scheme or scam that's going on. Danny, can you tell our listeners about what a charter school is, its functions, and why? Because, you know, Danny, there's more and more folks that have, you know, that are, you know, just regular folk, just common folk like you and I, and they have, you know, they have good intentions, but they're just misguided. I'm talking about, you know, community members, even some folks that are parents that, you know, I've had discussions with, and initially, you know, getting into these discussions, you know, they had they saw charter schools as like a panacea to education, and as I engage them in conversation, explain to them what this whole charter school, you know, scheme is about. You know, they had a different take, but that's because we're not living in a democracy, and so they're not getting, you know, information in a democratic manner, in a broad-based, you know, where people can be informed and make decisions that are best for them. So, for anyone that's listening now or that's going to listen on archive, can you explain? Kind of give us a I know it's a loaded question, but can you kind of break down charter schools and why it can have a very devastating impact on inner city communities if we see more and more of these charter schools just popping up left and right?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head, and that is there's been so much misinformation and disinformation that people can't think critically of the concept. So if you talk to the average person about a charter school, they wouldn't even be able to define what it is for you. And yet many people will embrace the concept, and yet they can't even define what a charter school is, either legally or economically or politically. And that tells you right away that, you know, that they're uncritically accepting something that they haven't really thought much about. So the question is why would people gravitate? I'll answer the question what a charter school is in a minute, but why would people gravitate toward a new form of education, be it charter schools or vouchers or anything else? And that is basically because they believe that under the current form of education, they're not getting an education or a fair shake. So let's bifurcate or split the question into two parts. People have to come to terms with whether they want the educational means of production. What I mean is whether they want education to be public or whether they want education to be private. That's the first step. So if you want public education, then you believe that education is a human right and that it can't be taken away from somebody and that everybody, no matter who they are, has a right to get an education and that we fought for this right for 500 years and that it should be never taken. And therefore, education should be the provider of education, should be the government, or it should be a public, put it on par with healthcare. There should be a public option for education. In other words, it should be just like healthcare should be run by private corporations, education should be run by private corporations. It should be public, owned by the public. Okay, so the first step that people have to understand is whether they want a public education or they want private education. If they want public education, then the question becomes is, you know, who makes the decisions in public education? And that's supposed to be a democratic decision-making that's based on oversight, transparency, full disclosure, democratic input, et cetera, et cetera. Usually school boards were the way that people would do it in their communities, and they'd have a local school in their community or whatever, and they make decisions. So what curriculum should be there and what, you know, kind of teachers should be hired. And it was all a public endeavor. It involved the public, it was for the public, et cetera. A private education is an education that's not provided by the public. Now, it may be financed with public funds, but the control of the education, the decision-making in the education is all done by private boards. And these boards are non-democratic. They're what's called autocratic. In other words, they're select hierarchical boards. All right, and the people that are on the boards make the decision as to what education is going to look like, how it's going to be funded, what's going to be taught, et cetera. Well, charter schools, so that's the first step. Okay, now the second step is then to ask oneself, well, what should a curriculum look like? What would a curriculum in a public school be different than a curriculum in a private school? What kind of curriculum should we have kids, you know, or for college students or whatever? You know, what do we want to be teaching? In essence, what does it mean to be an educated person in today's society? Until we can answer the question, what it means to be an educated person in today's society, until we answer that question, we won't know what to teach because we'll have no standards, no rubric, no way to judge whether we're teaching anything. See, I'm a full believer in standards, but not the phony standards that the corporations are talking about, which we'll talk about soon. So one is who's going to run and own the education? Will it be a public endeavor or is it going to be a private endeavor? And the second is what's going to be the content of the education? Well, for those of us that are proponents of public education, we believe it should be controlled by the public in a democratic process and that the content of the education should be an education that promotes critical thinking. And what I mean by that is critical thinking about different points of view, critical thinking about race, critical thinking about gender, critical thinking about economics, politics, personal life, social life. In fact, teaching a student how to reason their way through subject matter. All right, that there's a logic to everything that you study. And so many parents, especially my parents that live in poor neighborhoods, because the schools are funded by property taxes, so many parents in bad neighborhoods began to realize, you know, many, many years ago, that their kids are not getting very good public education. So along comes Mr. Privatizer. He comes down the street here. He's looking at a $500 billion educational industry, which if he can break open the public doors, can you imagine how much money that could be for Wall Street? And especially now where capitalism doesn't know where to invest its capital. That's why you have banks sitting on trillions of dollars. They won't invest anything because they can't make a profit. So if they could get a hold of this educational industry and get rid of public education and privatize it, they could sell test-taking equipment. They could sell textbooks, everything from pencils to garbage cans. Okay, they make a huge amount of money. So they tried in 1990s to do it with vouchers in Wisconsin. They tried to get rid of public education by coming up with a voucher system, whereby you would, as a parent, would get a certain amount of money from the state every year, and you could then go shop for schools. But that didn't work out well in Wisconsin, and people didn't buy it. So the privatizers got back in their Heritage Institutes and their Hoover Institutions and their Cato Institutions and their Reason Foundations and all the other myriad institutions that have existed for the last 35 years. And they went back to the drawing board and they came up with a great concept called a charter school. They said, look, this is how we can sell it to parents. It's going to be really easy. You don't like these big, factory, overcrowded urban schools, do you, where your kids get lost or they're treated like crap in the classroom and so forth and so on? Wouldn't you like a nice neighborhood charter school, you know, where you could just get together with other parents and teachers and start the charter school yourself? And it would be public because you would be financed by public money. But you would be able to make a decision what you wanted at your school, kind of curriculum, what would be emphasized, et cetera, et cetera. And that's a very alluring idea to people. In fact, it was a very alluring idea to the American Federation of Teachers, who embraced it in 1988. And they embraced the charter school concept. And so the right wing said, look, we can use it as a Trojan horse because they are not public schools. They are run by boards or they're run for profit, either in the front door or through the back door, but they are not public schools. Okay, and then we can get parents, okay, we can fire all the teachers, okay, we can get cheap labor, we can open up the schools, we can make a ton of money, and we can get rid of a big constituency in the United States called government workers and their unions so that we can take over the political offices that we need to take over and we won't have any unions that are standing in our way. And that's the plan that's been launched. And so if you're a young minority woman and you've got a 6-year-old kid that's just starting school, you don't want to send your kid to the school down the street that's got 5,000 kids in it where nobody's learning anything. You want to send you to a school where maybe there's 20 kids in the classroom and the teacher can give a specific attention. Well, that's what the charter schools say that they can give you. But, in fact, they can't give you that. You can't get into the charter school unless you're in a lottery system. Charter schools are filled to the brim, okay? They're being used, these charter schools, to set the tone for vouchers. First, they were used in New Orleans after 2005 to get rid of the entire teaching staff and the entire public school system. Once the charter schools were in, what did Bobby Jindal do 2 months ago? Vouchers.
Yep.
Got everybody all you get the families to hate public education, blame the teachers, blame the government, when in all actuality it has nothing to do with that, teachers or the government.
Right.
So a charter school is a school that is started under a charter. You basically have to apply with your school. You have to meet certain requirements in a given state. They have charter school requirements, and then you can start a charter school. But you can't start a charter school, you, Solomon, or any of your listeners. You don't have the money. You can't get a building to even have your charter school in. How are you going to get a building to have your charter school in? You can't run it out of your house. It's not like a daycare center. So the only people that can really start charter schools now are the people with money, and that's Wall Street, Goldman Sachs, Leads, Prudential Insurance. They're starting your charter schools for you. And we call them charter school retail chains. They sell education over the counter like a commodity. And they're heavily militarized, usually involving a lot of uniforms. Parents have to put in extra hours. The kids are sitting in chairs all day long. There's no playgrounds. They're operated out of strip malls. And it's just absolutely horrendous.
Thank you very much for that. You mentioned money and that you need a lot of money to start a charter school. So my question is, what roles do philanthropists like Bill Gates and Eli Broad have in this?
They're the it's a good question. They're the they're the billionaire boys club that Diane Ravitch talks about, and I talk about in my charter school book as well. They provide the seed money to leverage the destruction of public education into the hands of privatizers. So let me give you an example. In Newark, New Jersey, they have a Newark Venture Fund. Bill Gates just basically, you know, put billions of dollars in the Newark Venture Fund, and then he puts a sign up there and he says, "We're open for business. If you're interested in starting a charter school, come to us. We can get you started. We got seed money for you. We can get you pointed in the right direction to investors, vulture capitalists who may want to invest in you. We can help you with find a building. Once you find a building, we can get it up to code for you." So basically, you can't leverage the privatization of education with just public money, because the public purse strings are controlled by politicians and such. But if you can come in with billions of dollars, and you can leverage charter schools and political campaigns and all this kind of stuff with private funds, then once you get it started, it's kind of like building a home. You don't have enough money to build a home, but I got a friend that can come in and lay the foundation for you for free. Once he lays the foundation for you for free, then it's going to be a lot more cost effective for you to build a home. And that's what these people do. They come in the gates and all these. Their job is to destroy public education. They know the best way to destroy public education is, one, to use propaganda to tell people that public education is not in their best interest. It's terrible and you should never have it. Same with health care. You don't want, you know, a single-payer system. That's like Canada. You'll be sitting on a bench all the time. You'll never get any, you know. So this fear-mongering through propaganda. And then the second one, using private funds to leverage of the entire privatization plan, and then the third one, to capitalize on crises, and if there is no crisis, to create a crisis. And that's what austerity programs are all about. Okay, there's no crisis. There's plenty of money, but they want to create a crisis, and then when they create a crisis, they can come in and they can fix the crisis, and the only way they want to fix it is to privatize everything. Everything. From FedEx to schools to Dunkin' Donuts to whatever it is. They want to privatize everything. And this is goes back to the point I was making before. This is the reactionaries. This is what they're all about. They need to deny education, especially to people that are, you know, black people and Latino people, because if you can deny a person's past to them, then they will have no way to forge a liberatory path forward. And so that's what you're seeing in Tucson, Arizona, with the removal of the Mexican-American programs and stuff. Okay, don't let people know their real history. Deny them education. Give them Jim Crow. Privatized everything in life. Make sure they can't start unions. Mm. And this is totalitarianism.
Mm.
It's an attempt to repeal the Enlightenment. All the gains we've made. Okay, from universal education to the abolitionist movement to women's suffrage, they want to black bag the whole thing and just throw it away. And they will be very successful because if we do not organize and mobilize, because they control the media. And he who controls the image controls the mind. And so they've convinced a whole bunch of, you know, minority folks that charter schools are in their best interest, when in all actuality they're not at all. They're the worst thing that could ever happen to them.
Right, and it's interesting you brought that up, because when you were saying that they create the crisis, it's kind of like they created the crisis with Social Security. I mean, Social Security is not insolvent, but they've created this crisis, you know, under the guise of you know, we must privatize. What a wonderful idea! We must place Social Security, you know, under the control of these Wall Street banksters that helped
right.
us. First in 2007, 2008, you know. So
right.
I really appreciate that answer. that you.
But even more though, Solo, just to interject a minute.
Yeah, definitely.
If Social Security, of course, could be completely, it's flush with money till 2035. But you know, you only after $106,000 income, you don't pay into Social Security anymore. So the rich don't pay into Social Security. Of course they don't. They don't need it. They have their own financial planners. They don't need the public comments. But the other thing is, the Obama administration is stealing from the Social Security Fund right now and giving it back in the form of tax rebates to people. So we have a Democratic a president that's basically chipping away at Social Security now.
Right. Danny, what is it? You mentioned, you know, that these things are going to happen unless we mobilize, unless we organize. And I wanted to ask you a question, for you to put on your activist hat, and I'm asking this question because you're somebody who has spent the last, several decades of your life as an organizer. What is the best way for folks to organize around these attacks on public education? What's the best way that the average layperson, mom, dad, student, young person, older student, in various communities throughout America can mobilize to fight this?
Well, I think the number one, people have to begin to have discussions amongst themselves to begin to critically think about what's being presented to them by the reactionaries in this country as a salvo or a way to overcome problems that may occur in content with public education. That would be the first step. Then once, if a person finds himself generally on the side of public education and does not want to see public education destroyed in this country, then they have to fight for public education. And that can take on very different means of doing it. If you have a child in a public school, for example, that would give you a leg into the public school to begin to attend meetings that maybe the school would hold. If you're in a union, whether private or public, bring these issues to the union you might happen to be a member of and get the union to come out in solidarity with public education. Here in California, we're going to be, I think on March 8th is going to be, we're going to be going to Sacramento, in buses, tens of thousands of us from, kindergarten all the way up. And we're going to be demanding that there not only be no more cuts in education, but that education be completely reoxygenated with funds, et cetera, et cetera. It's got to be a unified solidarity, from the backyard to the boardrooms, where everyone happens to find themselves, to fight for public education, because if we don't fight for public education, there will be no public education. If there's no public education, there'll be no critical thinking. If there's no critical thinking, there'll be no critical citizenship. If there's no critical citizenship, we'll continue to sink into totalitarianism, and nobody will even know that we're sinking into totalitarianism because they won't know how to think about it. And so it's really a matter of people beginning to see that these issues are not, BBs in a bag, that the fight for public, health care is the same fight for public education, which is the same fight for public unions, which is the same fight for public transparency, which is the same fight, to get out of the military, which is the same, the whole thing is all connected. It's a fight for a different way to produce and reproduce our lives every day. We cannot go on like this. There's no way that this is sustainable. So that's what I would suggest. People find their own breath and their own voice wherever they are. And, organize a meeting at your home. Have somebody come over. Make some tea. Have a discussion about education. Things come out of stuff like that. That's how it begins. We need to. We're facing a new Jim Crow right now, Solomon. They're taking back all the gains that were made from the 1950s all the way, up until recently, in terms of civil rights for women and for blacks, and it's all being taken away. So if we don't stand up to fight now, then when do we stand up to fight?
Right. And I think the other thing is obviously, fighting. It's important for folks to know who their adversary is, and those folks who are in support of public education, that after they do their critical analysis and take a step back and say, yeah, I support public education, then if they do, then they can't look at this Obama administration from him to Arne Duncan as allies for public education, because their policies and the roles that they have played are you know, are complete affronts on public education and those that love it. And Danny, you know, you mentioned something earlier, and I just caught it because I remember you writing about it, you know, several months back. This organization in D.C. that very few people know about, and the name eludes me, the Something Council. Could you mention that? What is that?
Well, basically, again, you have it in Chicago. I mentioned it. Commonwealth Club, I think it was in Chicago. In Washington, D.C., it's called the Federal City Council, and it's basically a secret parliament made up of elites like the Bohemian Grove or the Bilderberg or, you know, any of these secret organizations. These people go and they go for retreats. And anyway, with the Federal City Councils in Washington, it was started in the 1940s by the owner of the Washington Post at the time, and it's maintained secrecy, and it basically calls the shots behind, you know, the political shots behind the scenes. And many, many cities have this, whether they're actually named or have a meeting place or a building, though the Federal City Council does. All cities have it because our country is run and controlled by a very small elite, not the 1%, the 1/10 of the 1%. And so wherever they live, they will control their entire environment around them. And that's how they are. They're power hungry, and they look to control people, the environment, and things. So every city has these people. All of them have it. You know, these are the people that meet behind the scenes and know transparency and make rules and regulations, and then they buy their politicians, their lapdog politicians, who then go out and put all this stuff into play. You know, which is what's going on in the South now with the new strategy, the American Legislative Executive Council, which is ALEC, which is the Koch brothers. You know, they're mm-hmm. busy taking over education, destroying environment, deregulating school boards, all through the South. All through the South. In preparation for the election that's coming up. That and the disenfranchisement of voters, okay, which is happening with these new laws in God knows how many states, again, mostly in the South. We may see 5 million people that can't even vote in this coming election. And so between the rigged voting, right, and the $1 billion in Citizens United that's being spent, we don't even know where the money's coming from. Anybody that thinks you live in a democracy is either asleep or has swallowed a Kool-Aid, one or the other.
Wow. Yeah, it's interesting, Danny. You know, I mean, thank you so much for that valuable information. And as you were speaking, I pull up their website, the Federal City Council, and they have the website. I mean, I'm sure you've been to the website many times, but they have this, you know, African American sister who has a, you know, she's in her graduation garb, you know, and it has, you know, their idea for education reform. I mean, people, you know, what Danny just said. Please Google Federal City Council, and you can get all that information that Danny was just talking about. But Danny, it's just I'm just browsing through it right now, and it's nefariously fascinating.
It is, Solomon, and just the words Federal City Council gives it a gravitas, makes it sound like it might be an agency of the government. It has nothing to do with the government. It is so secret, they won't even tell you where their money comes from, who's a member. The person that's the head of the membership is Donald Graham, who runs the Washington Post, and he's the one that knights people to be members. But, yeah, they won't even tell you who's involved, where they meet, what they do, nothing. But they make it look like a benevolent organization, maybe even a government organization. They've actually worked for urban removal in Washington, D.C. They got Michelle Rhee in there to privatize the schools. They've worked against the hospitals they've closed in there. They made sure they closed hospitals for poor people. They have a long legacy that people can read about if they Google them.
Right. And so, Dan, my last question before you go.
Yes.
You know, I just wanted to mention that, you know, we're talking about, you know, public education, and we look at some of the city, we look at nationwide, and we see that, black boys are graduating from high school at less than a 50% clip, and you know, some cities it's, you know, 33%, and we know there's, you know, there's a number of factors that go into that. A lot have to do with institutional racism, but with one of the the so-called like American dreams, you know, of going to college. If you could expound upon that so-called dream now, when that dream means that when you go to college, you know, most students that go to college, when they graduate, if they graduated, whether they graduate or not, they're anchored to this this student loan that, you know, on average is $24,000-$25,000, but in some cases, you know, it's upward of $50,000-$70,000, and can literally take, you know, decades to pay off. You know, you were on my show, you know, a couple months ago when we were talking about it. You know, is it unfortunately the same situation? Has it gotten better, or are we still looking at $1 trillion of student loan money that's floating out there? And how much of that student loan money are we looking at default? Because I believe that's one of the only forms of, I guess, loan or debt that you simply can't escape from by claiming a bankruptcy.
Well, the answer is that, much like healthcare, there are 55 million people that are uninsured. There's no universal access to healthcare. There's no universal access to education either from kindergarten all the way up. As I mentioned, charter schools, you have to be in a lottery to get in. And if you're not pulled in the lottery, can you imagine being in a lottery to go to school? If you're not pulling the lottery, you can't go to that school. So there's now, for colleges, of course, the tuition and fee increases have made public institutions and private institutions like Harvard or places like that out of reach for the average student, working class student. And there are reasons for this. So one is because they run as businesses, and they don't service students. They service capital construction projects and Wall Street, a number of things. But the bottom line is, with tuition and fees going up just astronomically all over the United States, people can't go to school. So how do they get in? Well, they have to borrow money. So in other words, in order to engage in wage labor under capitalism, you have to go into debt. Because a college graduate meant to make 77% more than a high school graduate. So if you want to make 77% more, you have to go into debt. That's the way we set up our system. It has nothing to do with getting an education. It's all about getting a diploma. So once you get the diploma, then you can get on the salary chart higher. And that's what education has been reduced and boiled down to, a sickening commodified roux that has really very little to do with education. But again, it's the public-private issue that has to be addressed. So if I apply to the University of Washington to go to school and my grades are really good, and I'm told by the University of Washington that 11% of all the seats or the slots in the school have been put aside for the burgeoning Chinese and Asian middle and upper classes, and therefore only 89% of the seats are open. I got to compete for 89% of the seats with 100% of the people because they set aside 11% for the Chinese. And then they tell me that the tuition is going to be $26,000 to go to school there, and I can't get in. If I can't get in, I can't pay the $26,000, and where will I go? I'll go to your Strayer Online or your Capella or your Kaplan or your University of Phoenix or your ITT schools or your DeVry Institute. And that's how the reactionaries make a market for predatory educational private institutions like Apollo, just take an example. Much like the healthcare industry, if we had universal access to healthcare, we would have no need for Blue Shield, Blue Cross, none of it. None of it would exist, because nobody would go out and buy private healthcare if they were getting decent, adequate public healthcare. Just like people on Medicare don't go buy another policy. It's Medicare. Okay, well, it's the same with schools. You want to get rid of these phony for-profit colleges that are sucking up $40 billion of the educational budget? Then you create universal access to education. It won't even exist. But the plan is now in reverse. It's to destroy education publicly so that the private market is open. So we create a market for these colleges. And that's what the politicians have been hired to do. They're not elected. They're selected. And they're hired by the ruling class to create markets for them, to pass laws favorable to that market. And so that's why we see a proliferation of these online schools, phony predatory schools that cheat students, where the graduation rate in Washington, D.C. is 6%. It means 94% of the students don't graduate. They go to the government, they borrow money, they give it to the private operators who take it to Wall Street, who boost their stocks up, who pay themselves, in Kaplan's case, $239 million in CEO bonuses over 5 years, right? They deliver a horrible education, no education at all, and they leave students by the side of the road. It's student dumping instead of patient dumping. Instead of the private corporation that can't, doesn't want to insure you, dumping you as a patient in the downtown Los Angeles because you don't have health care, they dump you as a student now downtown Los Angeles. When you've borrowed all the money you can and you've dropped out, now you owe the money, and it's non-dischargeable debt in bankruptcy, and the corporations have got it, their money, they left, and there you are. So it's a tragedy. So there's 30% unemployment for youth in this country. Jobs that I used to do as a kid at 13, like mowing somebody's lawn, have become professional jobs now. Right, you see people in their 70s mowing lawns. So the jobs that used to go to high school kids and stuff, they're now going to people in their 60s and 70s that can't retire. So there are no jobs for kids. They're living at home. They're watching the television, and they see an ad pop up that says, you want to be a chef? You want to be get involved in the military-industrial complex or the military security complex? You know, go back to school. Get a degree. You can get 12 units in 9 weeks. And that's where higher education is now. That's where it is. There's nothing higher about it, and there's nothing educatory about it at all. It has nothing to do with education. It has nothing to do with high or low. It has to do with money.
Dr. Danny Weil,
yes.
I just want to thank you for coming on the show, because I learned a lot of things I did not know prior to listening to you. So I'd like to thank you for impacting that knowledge on me and on our listeners. But before you leave, what way can we get in contact with you, like our listeners, like if they have follow-up questions or they want to invite you to a talk or anything like that?
Oh, yes. My email is weilunion, W-E-I-L-U-N-I-O-N, all one word, weilunion, @AOL.com. I still have one of those old addresses. And anybody can write me, and I'll always answer their questions. Or you can go to Daily Censored, which is a news blog or whatever you'd call it. And you'll see I write articles 3-4 times a week that are there, and you can read other people's articles and my own, or just Google my name if you want to. But anybody is always free. Feel free that they can write me. I may not have all the answers, but I will answer your emails.
Thank you so much. Thanks a lot, Danny.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it. All right.
Well, thanks to both of you. Thank you very much, and you be well. I'll talk to you both soon.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
So that was, Nisa, that was Danny. It was another excellent, excellent interview. And I see we have a caller. I don't know if they've been online for a while. I don't know if they're listening on air. I'll just put them through for a second. If not, we'll go to a brief musical interlude and wrap this up. Caller on line one, did you have a comment or a question?
No, just listening.
Okay, all right, no problem. All right, and there's nothing wrong with that. Folks can listen anytime they want. We love it. So we're going to go to a brief interlude. This is Zion I in America, and then Nisa and I will come back and wrap the show up.
What? Wanna see my ID?
In America.
Going West Philly?
In America.
Some plays overseas?
In America.
African in my jeans?
In America.
Them sucker police, I don't got any beef, so why they wanna beat me?
In America.
They kill the natives with disease, smallpox or sheep, African and Chinese?
In America.
Young soldiers go die?
In America.
Unemployment too high?
In America.
Got the prisons real big?
In America.
Thanks. Peel wigs.
In America.
A lot of guns okay, they sick to play, they steal the money all day?
In America.
Don't get paid, 98 in the shade, and life feel like a maid.
In America.
I'm here to tell you, in case you don't know, be self-evident that there is power in numbers.
Man, hippie, come on, get out of here,
cut it. I tell you, shit ain't sweet, man, they live on the street without nothing to eat.
In America.
Many kids fool by, all the TV style, you see a pretty drive by.
In America.
But we can live like that.
In America.
How many live like that?
In America.
I never lived like that.
America.
Nobody lives like that.
America.
And when I have never seen.
Nisa, you are currently a university student in America, you know, you're also considered international because you hail from Dominica, so you didn't attend high school here, but you are nonetheless a university student. And my question is to you, how do you, you know, after that interview and before then, you're also, interesting enough, an education major. What is your view? Because I'm almost certain that most of your peers have been trained in a very linear type of way and haven't gotten this kind of outside perspective. So their notions and ideas of education are probably, you know, radically different from the standpoint that they're more narrowly focused. But, you know, how do you see, you know, education and, you know, your reflections on the interview in general?
First of all, starting the interview in general, like I was saying earlier on, it was very informative, whole new view, breakdown of how things actually work behind the scenes. With education, I guess comparing American education with that of, well, I'm from the Caribbean, so I have to say the Caribbean education. Naturally, my education from primary to tertiary, because I went to 2-year college in Dominica, it was pretty much free. You know, you pay like a little bit of money, but it wasn't all that. Where at the end of your school year, you have this major debt that you have no idea how you're going to get rid of it or even try to pay it off. Education here, especially in my, because I'm a second language education minor, so we deal with the policies, the different philosophies in teaching and everything like that, you know, in that minor only. I'm not majoring in the education right now, but just the minor alone, it gives you this view, this really rosy view that you have all those theories, you know, to help you in the classroom. So if you just apply all those theories in different ways, in different forms, and you just really use your brain and your mind and your imagination, that you can actually build successful students. But when you have a system that is prepped for, you know, the whole system to fail, for the students to fail, it's kind of pretty difficult to actually see how that's going to become a reality. And debt-wise or everything, I mean, I'm attending a state college, so you would think that it would be cheaper than a private college or private university, and it's worse, actually. I'm actually surprised, because every single thing on this campus, you have to pay for it. And the things that you think are part of the university, they are actually contracted. So you pay in double. And just to apply to, I guess, higher, to the grad school on this campus is as well expensive compared to that of Ivy League schools. For instance, just the application fee to go to the to grad school is $75, but with Columbia University, it's $65. You know, the GPA standards here is way higher than that of an Ivy League school. So I'm just saying, like, really, Maryland, it's not that difficult. So basically, they make it hard for you, but at the same time, what they're teaching you in the classroom is this ideology that you can be a super teacher, you know, and everything. Like, they make it in the sense, like, it's on you if it doesn't, if you don't be, like, successful students.
Right. Yeah, you're right on that. And, you know, and the way I see it is, you know, someone who's been through the rigors of this, you know, educational system, you know, which I would call a factory for indoctrination. You know, when Danny was talking about, you know, parents and community members who see charter schools as like a panacea to, and naturally, and my heart goes out to them, you know, they want better, you know, education, you know, they want better schools for their children. And But the problem is not necessarily the schools. The money is there. It's not a crisis, as Danny said. The money is there. They're just not, putting the money. They're not pumping the money into revamping the schools in terms of everything from infrastructure to provide, to revamping the curriculum, making it more laden with critical thought. And their parents come from these factories, these school factories that are all based around indoctrination, have a extreme lack of any kind of critical thinking curriculum. So they get out, and so they're trained not to critically think. They're trained not to break down and deconstruct dominant narratives and information that's fed to them as a means to looking at things democratically, looking at things from a wide perspective. And so it's given to them from the corporate media or politicians, what have you, and boom, that's it. That's the way that, where that's the lay of the land. But on the ugly truth is that charter schools are not providing unlimited opportunities and resources for the vast majority of kids in the inner cities. The vouchers are not either. There's only a certain amount of vouchers, and that certain amount of vouchers is not expanded to, and they don't talk about this, is not expanded to the vast majority of inner city youth. It's like a lottery system, and so you have these parents who are good intentioned, who desperately want to get these vouchers, and when they don't get these vouchers through this effed up lottery system, they're left on the outside, and with this hopeless feeling, where, as Danny was talking about with the healthcare industry, education should be a public institution. It shouldn't be privatized. It shouldn't be corporatized. All right. The vast resources that this country has should not be spent on things like war and weaponry and nuclear weapons and military bases and these kind of things. The bailouts shouldn't be going to, Wall Street elites and so forth. And the rich shouldn't be taxed. They shouldn't be taxed. The rich who are sitting on top of capital gains should be taxed. Much more. They shouldn't be taxed less than those people that are out there doing manual labor. There's many, many ways where money can be directed into education. But the money is there. Even before that, the money is there. It's not a priority in this country, and it's not a priority because the ruling class, the elites, NISA, they can't have a critical thinking, well engaged, educated mass populace. They can't. They have to have a lower class that is so-called uneducated, that doesn't have that little certificate known as your college degree, and that for some reason means that you got it. It means that you're smarter than the rest, and if you're smarter than the rest, it means that you're qualified to take certain jobs, and so you walk around thinking, those that get it walk around thinking that, oh, I'm better, man, because I got this college degree. Oh, I got it. Yeah, master's degree. I got this degree. But at the same time, they're getting paid. Many of those folks are getting paid in livable wages themselves. But the lower class, those folks who haven't had the opportunity by design to go and get that college degree, they're left for these jobs that these scumbags that orchestrate the system want them to be in, because they can pay them a pittance. Because they can, by the definition, in this country where injustice and a system of the haves and have-nots and this rapacious capitalism is what keeps them going. It keeps them going at the expense of people, their lives, their families, their children, and they languish and decay. Year after year, decade after decade, generation after generation, these people are nothing short of scumbags that orchestrate the system. And those that support it, I will say, are scumbags too, because many of those that support it understand exactly how it works. So people need to get extremely angry, and as they get angry, get extremely organized, and there needs to be no compromise. Dump the Democratic Party. If you're voting Republican, lose that foolishness. Dump them, start to to organize with other working class folks, start to put together ideas about forming independent candidates and third parties, you know, if you will, you know, because otherwise, you know, I'm telling you, our children and children's children are going to be continue to be, you know, lamb for the slaughter, and mental slaughter, which equates to, you know, just, you know, just systems and, you know, just I would say widgets, the use of the elites. And so that brings us to the end of the show. Nisa, I want to thank you again for coming on. And it's time to fight the power, the so-called power. You know, there's no other way about it. And with that, we're gonna you know, go out with a song that I like, and it's called "The Game Is a Battlefield." Regain your minds, folks. It's time. Regain your minds. It is time.
This is a mockery of your number one station that's brainwashing the nation, playing the same old stereotypical musical as usual. With no balance or substance, cause you motherfuckers love it.
They scared of real hip hop, like the threat of war. The game is a battlefield, but it's not a metaphor, it's real life. You get drafted by the A&Rs, you get sworn in and join in to play your part like a soldier. With no choice, you are what they say you are. They use your voice to wage a war. They send you across lands and over airways. The video program is like an air raid. Women and children in the line of fire. Today rappers is like mercenaries, soldiers for hire. Dog tags is gold chains, slugs is raps, killing brown and blacks. Like campaigns in Iraq, minefields in the wax. If it don't blow up, you get a bayonet in your back. Back on the block like a vet in the wheelchair, no health care. The same way the rap gang did the first pioneers of the battlefield.
It's a takeover, not a makeover.
The word is the bullet. Peter Tosh had an AK for a guitar. I'm Che, but my pen is my cigar. Urban Gorilla Griot, other side of the peephole. It's a war outside. I say Fleo, Leo, Smeo, is it real? Audio terror, this ain't a drill. Now your helmet is a new era. Fashionista army apparel. Gun barrel, radio waves. Rapid return fire. Street call desire. It's the fall of the empire. Download your freedom using hi-fi, Wi-Fi. Spy verse spy. It's a media lie. Identify yourself, soldier. We ain't making classics no more. We getting over. Keep looking over your shoulder. Study the terrain. See, they watching the internet. They're studying your brain. And politics is war without guns. I said it before. Now they turn the battlefield into a dance. Floor, and it's hard to the core if you start to explore. It's hard to the core if you start to explore.
Motherfuckers are really listening. This would have never been really played on the radio. It's a takeover.